Welcome to this very special episode of the Friday Sessions. Today, we covered a lot of ground. We kicked off with Alex Hormozi breaking the internet, doing $150 million of sales in one day of his latest round of books. We then talked about this new proposed four-hour work week that has been talked about at the Talkfest in Canberra this week. We talked about the AI dilemma. We went quite deep on this and really thought about, like, what would happen? Is it possible that businesses should actually pay their staff to do nothing and sit at home while AI replaces their jobs? I know that sounds outrageous for a bunch of capitalists, but we actually talked about that and how there might actually be some merit in that for the future of the country. We then talked about the power of incentives and what places like China and Dubai are doing right now to attract wealthy, talented people to their countries and what we can learn from them here in Australia. We talked about Bitcoin and what's going on, four big stories that happened in Bitcoin this week. And then we talked about Dubai at the very end and just some of the incredible vision that is happening there, but also importantly, what Australia can learn from it. And the last 2 minutes of this podcast, we made a very special invitation for our community to potentially join us in Dubai on the 23rd, 4th, and 5th in Dubai for a very, very elite group of people to get private backstage tours of some of the most exciting projects happening in Dubai. I'm going to be there. Eric's going to be there. A bunch of our inner circle are going to be there. Originally, this event was designed specifically just a private event between us mates in our own private WhatsApp group. We don't know that we're going to run it yet. If you're interested, though, I mean, outside of that, if you are interested, I give you the email address at the end if you want to find out more information about possibly joining us. If there's enough support, we might open it to you guys who listen to us on the pod to come and hang out with us in Dubai for a few days, and we talk about that at the end. It's going to happen either way, but if you want to come, you can possibly join us. With that said, I think you're going to really enjoy this one. We tried to keep it not too heavy, but interesting. I think you'll quite like it. Bye for now. I'm just going to start with this today, guys. I am so glad that the pre-roll is not recorded at the start of these pods, because if they were, we'd get cancelled in 5 seconds. But welcome back, everybody. Marky, Tourette's de Pola. Nice to have you here.
I'm doing good. I'm freaking good.
Well, we have taken note, guys. Mark is on strict no swearing or limited swearing orders after last week's.
Thanks, guys. You've literally put me on coin jar over here. The boys have set up a coin jar, and I have to donate Bitcoin to
at a time.
Luckily, it's not one Bitcoin per swear word. That's all I can say. Guys, what a week. It's been a hell of a news cycle in the last 7 days. So much going on around the world. There's more crazy stuff obviously happening in Australia, some exciting stuff happening in America. But why don't we start with some business stuff? Because, you know, we always seem to get pulled into the rabbit hole of the clown show that is Australia at the moment. And, you know, for the listeners, you know, I don't take any joy. In fact, I've really, really been reflecting on how far down that rabbit hole I want to go, because it's super negative. I hate putting up reels that are dumping on Australia. And I think all of us hate putting up content that is dumping on Australia. But on the other side of it, I think all of us are genuinely concerned about the trajectory of the country at the moment. So it's a really hard, you know, things sort of balance. And this week I put out a reel, and it was kind of very hard to put it out. I sat on it for 2 days about immigration stuff. It's been overwhelmingly positively received, but, you know, it's a really tough one. And I'd love to hear feedback in the comments of, you know, what you guys want to hear more of as well, and make sure that we're not going down too far down a rabbit hole that you don't want to listen to. We're trying to keep it relevant to Australians. We're trying to give business commercial value, and we're trying to balance being relevant and speaking about things people care about. So feedback, welcome. With that said, let's start with, you know, the big story out of the US business scene this week, which was, of course, none other than Alex Hormozi. And this incredible story of how he basically broke the internet, set a world record for selling the most number of books online. Who followed that story? Who can sort of fill the audience in a little bit on it?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of caught up on it. It was a fairly long launch in his usual format. Like, he's done $100 million leads, $100 million offers. And he does these spectacularly large, usually free launches for one of his modules or in his suite of modules in his, how he runs all his businesses that he gets through his M&A shop called acquisition.com. And usually over the last 3 years when he's done a launch, it's all been free and he blows everyone away with tons and tons of value. excuse me. And what he put together was his third book called Million Dollar Money Models. And so that was the lead magnet. And he did all his usual marketing from all the different angles that he's sort of displayed in his other books on how to generate leads. And so it all goes off. Everyone loves it. And he said he had a surprise coming. And this time he actually asked for some money. So we had 3 years of credibility up his sleeve. And he sold, I think it was a $5,900 program, which is like his 12 module Bible plus an AI plus this, plus this, plus this. He's an unbelievable guy putting an offer together. And yeah, it did 150 million. And it's still open now. I just checked it now. The sales page has got about another hour or two to go. So who would know what the real number is, but I would dare say with a time-sensitive midnight offer, it could probably crack the $200 million selling a bunch of books. And the thing I found quite exceptional about it was obviously it's not a bunch of books. It's his whole playbook on how to run his companies. And then he puts every single one of his companies that's in his portfolio through the same model. So it's probably the best in class at the moment, if you're looking to get involved with that. But one little nice piece you put in there was the $5,980 is you get 200 books to give away. So it's a 100% deductible expense. So he didn't leave anything out there on the field, that's for sure. And it was quite spectacular. My business partner's gone through the launch. It went for about 10 hours. So that's a long webinar for those who do online marketing and selling info. A 10-hour event is quite long. So
was it a studio live stream, or was it like just a Zoom call, or how was it actually facilitated?
I'm just starting to go through it now. And he has all different guests and he had different sets and the whole lot. And he's sitting down doing his usual, drawing it out, penning it out, whiteboard, that whole scenario. So it was quite an interactive event, but it was all virtual, obviously.
And do you know how many people were on there, James? Was there any data on that?
I haven't actually got that data. When I was looking at the live stream at the tail end, there was about 380,000 I saw on the YouTube ticker. But again, that was over the course of the day. It could have peaked and troughed, who knows. So I'm not across the actual specifics of it, but I know in all the, you've got all the other internet marketers out there at the moment, the who's who, the Alex Beckers, the Kearns, and all these guys just going, wow, that was a masterclass in internet marketing.
So, he's about the only info marketer that's making more than OnlyFans girls, which is amazing.
Who knows? He probably streamed it through OnlyFans as well. Who knows?
I mean, guys, I think the real big takeaway for this, especially young people watching this, is when I hear this number, having been around the info marketing space for 30 years, this is just unheard of. This dwarfs anything done by Tony Robbins. It dwarfs anything done by any info marketer probably ever. And he did it digitally from his office in Las Vegas, which is the former UFC headquarters, just a fun fact, people who don't know that. Yeah. But, the thing that I would be saying to young people or anybody really listening to this, even if you have no intention of buying Alex's books, you are a fool if you have an interest in the space and you are not paying to attend whatever it is he has to just solely reverse engineer what he did. That's how you learn. And, to have such an entrepreneur as Alex, and I've seen the rise of Alex. I was on stage with Alex in the States when I got my $10 million award with ClickFunnels, and he was just coming up then. Nobody even knew who he was, really. He had the handlebar moustache. He was there with Layla, and they'd cracked, I think that they were up to 100 million or something in gross sales, or 80 million or something. But that's nothing compared to where he is today. And just to see the rise of him over the last 5-6 years has been absolutely amazing. Just an incredible, incredible story. Do you guys have any comments on this one before we move on?
Sorry, didn't see you there. While you're here, actually, we've got a new coaching cohort that just opened up for the Unemployable Property Coaching Program that you get taught on how to become a property developer. One-on-one coaching, bi-monthly coaching, and also events where we get a full coach bus with all the students and go to 6-7 different development sites. When I say development sites, from one lot to 10 lots to 50 lots, you get to see exactly why we buy it, how we buy it, how we fund it, and also how you can do it yourself. The next day, we had an amazing event at the QT Hotel here on the Gold Coast where we had all of our consultants come in and teach everybody on what they're looking for with sites, what are the different trends, and how you can become a property developer yourself. Now you see me on the video, but who you're gonna be getting coached by is Shannon and Carson. Who's Shannon and Carson? 4 years ago, Carson was cleaning carpets. Shannon was a machine operator. Today, they're doing over $100 million worth of land deals. I know you're listening, and I know you want to take action. And if that's you, click on the link below or go to www.unemployableproperty.com.au and register your interest, and one of our team will reach out to you, and we'll see you on the next bus. Now get out of here.
I actually just looked and it said there was over a million registrations. So there's not a lot of data yet, but over a million registrations, which is quite incredible. It goes to show you.
How many books did he sell? did it say how many books he sold?
Still selling 2.5 million copies in the mere hours.
2.5 million. Yeah. But it goes to show you the amount of value that he's brought over the years, right? Like there's no one else, in my opinion, giving the value that he's given over many years, right? And that's his whole model, right? Value. And to go and like convert $150 million over a weekend. And it's not like it's him and Layla. Those are the people, right, that are basically in front of camera. It's not like they're bringing in tons of different people, which is amazing. Like you look at the likes of Tony Robbins and these guys, like they've got a full blown team that are coming on, right? Obviously Hormozi will have a team in the back end, but just on the front end, it's him, like literally there, you know.
I got a stat that Mozi trained up 300 telephone assistants to be able to help people to get abandoned carts at checkout, like nuts. And there was another scene at the start of it because like the full 25-minute countdown and then the whole setup. So it was a nice preamble. The three different distribution centers to get his books out within, I think it was 48 hours or something like that. It was like a few hundred people per distribution center. He wanted those books out. As soon as they're bought, they have to be packed, wrapped, shipped, ready to go in MX store style time frame. So pretty bonkers.
That's something I want to comment on, right? Because we've got something that is kind of relevant to that with our business. So we're on Amazon and we're trying to get Shopify up and running, and we've done like something like $17,000 worth of sales in 6 months, right? So it's not great at all. But what I find is that we're often spending money somewhere because we think that that's going to improve the result. But then when you break down the flow chart of all the areas that are important for the success to happen, it's so downstream of where the problem is that it's like, why did you just spend money there? So for example, we just spent $5,000 or $6,000 US on CRO, like the product pages and trying to improve conversion. But if you look a little bit deeper at our flow, we're not getting enough traffic. And so our conversion rate isn't even that bad compared to the traffic. And at the moment, the cost per CPMs is too high. And I think what is amazing about Hormozi, and James, you just alluded to it, he's got every single friction point of that process honed in, right? And I don't think people appreciate just how big of a feat that is until you actually go out and try and do some online marketing, right? Like that only comes with experience and having to troubleshoot every single friction point. And there's probably something like 30 or 40 or 50 friction points that he has to work through. And I think that's the real genius of Hormozi, is that just through reps, and you can see he's a guy that likes doing reps, right? That he just continues to improve every single point in the process, and that's why he's been able to deliver the result he just did, right?
And that was just the event that he had to go to friction points. Then he's got the actual deliverable as well, and everybody bought his books or done his courses. But those who want these free stuff,
follow up
acquisition.com/leads, acquisition.com/offers, and those two books that he previously did those massive book launches for, he's actually got them in a video course content free of charge. So that'd be a good place to start.
His post-purchase funnels, and then he's got his increasing his lifetime value funnels. Like he's mastered every single step of internet marketing. just incredible.
And that's where you what you see there, or what you're talking about there, Mark, is the piping, right, in behind the front. It's not just a day of, you know, production. I mean, that alone takes a lot of focus and energy and effort to produce the content and to plan the content and have all the maps and models and everything done. But that's where the discipline and obsession of Hormozy shines. Like, this is a guy that chows down nicotine gummies and works literally in a, not even kidding, he works in a corner deliberately facing a wall with two walls either side of him like this, with headphones on all night. Like, and he does that. He has no kids. It's just him and Layla, and he works all hours of the day, and he's completely obsessed and fired up neurologically. Like, it's extreme. Like, he is the David Goggins of business execution. It's not like just talent. It is absolute sacrifice and obsession to produce at that level. And it's magnificent to watch. And, you know, I'm not that guy. I'm too lazy, to be honest. You know, he's just completely obsessed.
The one of the probably the most remarkable things I found about it is that when you bought this program for $5,980, there was zero digital delivery. It's all in books. It's all gets shipped out to you. There's no online portal. There's none of that. They're meant to be workbooks that you mark up, draw through the whole lot. But also, it stops the sharing of logins pretty quick, doesn't it? You're not going to sort of hand your books around to your mates to get ahead. But plus, you've got to do the work. You've got to actually read the book and absorb the information. So there's an interesting online digital event for a physical delivery.
Go ahead, no, I was just going to say, you know he's doing something right when people kind of hold him in the same regard as they hold David Goggins. Like, there's so many people that just can't stand Hormozy. He's like, oh, who would want to work that hard anyway? And who, like, and it's like, I wouldn't want to work that hard. I wouldn't want to do what he does. But you can't bag the bloke. Like, you've got to stop and admire, because it's a form of genius. What he does, the ability to dial in and to do what he does day after day and day, it's pretty incredible. If most people just did 10% of what he did, that'd be super fucking successful. Oops.
Yeah,
there's one in the coin.
There's one. It's mad respect for Alex, you know. Like, and I think I guess my point for the listener is, it's not just talent. Don't tell yourself this lie that it's just a God-given talent. No, it is. Talent earned through sacrifice and real clarity about what he wants in his life. He knows what he wants. If you look at his life is him, Layla, probably an inner circle of 10 or 20 people, and that's it. He doesn't have friends. He doesn't have social life. He doesn't drink. He lifts, he works, and he has Layla. That's Alex. And he seems to find joy in that circle. Brian Johnson says the same thing with his anti-aging stuff. I know I look psychotic from the outside, like the routine and the life I live to try and do this, but I find the freedom and joy inside of this extreme expression of obsession. So it's interesting. It's great having those people in that world.
Jocko Willink says the same thing. He says, you know, he talks about freedom a lot, and he says the ultimate freedom comes from discipline, and it's true. And it's, you know, I dropped something in our stock chat the other day, just in relation to trading being the ultimate expression of creativity, because there's so many infinite ways that you can put on a trade, and I've often spoken about how nothing kind of shapes you as a person like trading, like even more than like being in a relationship and kids and whatever. And it's because of those infinite degrees of freedom. And so that's something that even in trading that I'm going through at the moment, is to try and build my discipline with reps, build my discipline. It's like, it's not by consuming more information or reading more reports or paying for more subscriptions. It's about the discipline and the reps. And so, you know, I think there's so much that can be learned from Hormozy, especially when it comes to that discipline and seeing it in action. But, you know, don't kid yourself. Like, it doesn't matter what industry you're in, podcasting, business, e-com, you know, even in your career, the thing that separates you from what you want, I think is discipline, right? Discipline is that bridge, discipline and execution.
Yeah. All right, you guys would be very proud of me with discipline, actually, because I've got my new anti-aging cream and I put it on my face at night for the last 20 days straight. So, you know,
look at it.
That's discipline, mate.
I don't know.
Glowing, bro, glowing.
I don't, I just don't think it was underneath your eyeballs that it went. We're not allowed to swear here, so. You know, but how is everything else looking, Eric?
Look at those cheeks, though. Look at those cheeks. I mean, there's a right. Baby's bum cheeks. So,
$307 for the cream. Something better be.
You live in a house with three girls, mate. Like we got to give you a bit of a pass. You got the wife and two girls. I'm definitely going to do it. Let's move on from Alex. One thing I will say, there's a great pod out this week where a great podcast called My First Million. They interviewed Alex and they went right through his net worth with him. Like, and it was really interesting because Alex was totally transparent. Said, this is how much cash I have. This is how much real estate I have. This is exactly how much I got at each exit. This is my net worth. It was very interesting to see how he thinks about money and how he, you know, how he stores and invests. So if you want to watch that, just Google it. It's just come out.
Do you remember his net worth?
Yeah, it was about excluding the value of his equity stakes, just in stuff outside of business. So like his stake in school, he said is worth a lot, but it's not, he doesn't count that because it's not liquid. So just in terms of real estate, cash and different things, I think it's about 150 million before this book launch, which is probably now double that, but 150 million in cash and like he bought the UFC headquarters and a few other things. And he talks about how he does it. And interesting, he does first mortgage lending, which is really interesting. He's done a lot of that. It's very interesting. So have a look and listen to that. So really good. Moving on, talking about discipline and focus and like the rewards of like deep work. I was really encouraged this week to see the ACTU arguing at the Talk Fest for a four-day work week in Australia, because that's going to be amazing for productivity because we're such a productive nation as it is right now. That was also a really encouraging development. What did you guys think of that? Were you cheering that all the way home for our small absolutely. Business operators, like yeah, cafe absolutely. Owners who live in a world where their customers come in 7 days a week and their employees just want to work four? I mean, what do you guys think?
Yeah, even better now for small businesses. Just become even better of a country for small businesses. And you sent us something else recently about someone who couldn't find employees, has to ship them in from overseas.
It's a friend of a friend. JP is the owns Drake Supermarkets, and he was on both. I think it was Both Sides, or it might have been. It was another big podcast in Australia this week, and it blew up in news because he basically said to run our supermarkets, we have to bring in offshore labor because nobody wants to work. We can't get any Australian employees to actually apply to work in our supermarkets. And I know JP, I've met him a couple of times, I don't know him really well, but he's really close friends with Richie, who we're all good mates with, right? They're very, very close. They have a very successful business, but they just can't get staff. And so anyway, so it's a, you know, the drama continues. I get it for like big business. And I think one of the biggest challenges in Australia from a government point of view is they just fail to delineate between big business like banks and insurance companies and so on and small businesses that are working with a completely different, you know, reality. You can't run a cafe, you know, that way because they're open when they're open, you know. So anyway, it's just, I don't want to get too negative on it, but I just hope that Australians are becoming a bit more politically interested.
I posted something yesterday and a lot of people commented back because I'm like, well, if they want a 4-hour work week, it'll turn into a 3-hour work week because nobody really works on Fridays anyways. Correct. So I take note of how quiet my phone is on a Friday. I just want everyone to take note, right? Emails, text messages, WhatsApp messages, and phone calls on a Friday compared to any other day of the week. Very, very quiet. And actually people picking up their phone on a Friday, right, is very, very rare, especially after 12 o'clock. Forget about it.
I honestly think, Eric, you know, I think that we've become lazy, or is it that we're just so burned out and cooked, right, because of inflation and how much things are costing, I don't know what it is, but it's probably a combination of those.
I was going to say, with that 4-hour work week, I haven't really kept abreast of the news. Were they saying instead of doing your 38 hours over 5 days, you still do the 38 hours over 4 days, or they're saying cut it out?
Yeah, they're saying do it during the 4 days.
Okay. Well, if you look at productivity in general, out of an 8-hour workday, if you're getting 2 hours max productivity out of someone or employee, even yourself, you know, unless you're doing deep work early in the morning, whatever time it is you, and hepped up on nicotine pills like Hormozy, you're getting probably two. If they're doing a 10-hour day, you're still hitting the same 2 hours of productivity. Someone is paying more for the same outcome based on a 4-day week is what I'm saying.
Right. It's like I'm a believer in, like, yes, there's probably a partial of burnout and a partial of laziness, Adam, but I am not, like, I'm hiring an EA at the moment. And let me tell you, it's not one from Australia. People are going to bash me in the comments and the rest of it. That's fine. But, like, the quality of people that I am getting in applications from overseas through a proper company is unbelievable. I'm talking, like, people with multiple, like, MBAs, multiple diplomas, you know, 10 years experience working for very, very high level corporate EA, man, like someone that would probably cost here 150 grand, right? That would want to work maybe 4 hours. I mean, 4 days a week now is an example of this thing actually passes through. But we have to realize, you know, a work week isn't a 4-day work week. If anything, work weeks now are becoming larger, you know, like 6-day work weeks is probably a bit more normal in the average person's life. But for what I can get there is literally a fraction of, I'm talking about 1/5 to 1/6 of the cost.
What are you expecting it'll cost, Derek?
About 30,000 Aussie. And that's like, I'm talking 30,000 Aussie will give you a top-notch person. You could go and pay less, you know, 1200 a month and 1500 a month and this and that, but for between 2500 to 3000 a month, you're getting someone on a very, very high level. And the person that I'm using, which I'm not going to mention now because we're going to be doing some work with, and I'll be announcing that soon, right? They have a very, very large company here where they have 100 employees from overseas, right? And this is real numbers, right? Like 100 people overseas, and they are about 60% of the workforce, right? But they are actually less than 50% of the cost than the people actually here. And that's a scary thing, right? But in business, when I'm putting my business hat on, not the, okay, I feel bad for everybody. When I put, okay, Eric, business hat on, is businesses are having no choice but to look at these other ways to hire people. And it's unfortunate. It's actually unfortunate.
Thing is, Eric, you know, like I saw a comment this week, somebody put in our socials, and I thought it was interesting because it was around that. It was a reel that we posted about that Brisbane law firm that got sued by a Filipino contractor. Yep. And the Filipino contractor was a lawyer getting $20 an hour based in the Philippines. And she claimed unfair dismissal in our court system using our taxpayer dollars to sue her Brisbane employer. So $20 an hour was really good pay in the Philippines. But she was unhappy with the way that she was let go, and they had their reasons. Anyway, they let her go. And anyway, one of the comments that somebody said was, it's really interesting how everybody's up in arms about it now that small businesses are becoming well-known to do it. But how long have the big businesses of Australia been doing it? How long have banks and insurance companies been offshoring Australian jobs, airlines? When was the last time you got an Australian answer the phone? One shout out I want to give to Tom Tate and the Gold Coast City Council. Think what you like about Tom Tate, but when you call the Gold Coast City Council, guess who picks up? An Australian person sitting in Bundle in the head offices. You get picked up quickly. They are Australians that you're speaking to, and it's like unbelievable. And every time I've called them, I've said, I just want to say thank you for this experience, because it's so nice to talk to an Aussie. But my point is, I had a bit of an intellectual, I wouldn't mind bouncing this guys off you guys. The other thing that the ACTU is talking about at this talk fest in Canberra that's going on with Chalmers and Albo is the other thing that some professors are putting forward it's the professors that are putting forward, I think, the four-day work. No, the professors are putting forward the capital gains tax on principal place of residence, which I want to loop back to, which would be a shit show for a number of reasons. I mean, obviously, it would be good in some respects, but it would be very bad in others. But the other thing that they're talking about is this AI problem, right, with massive job losses going to occur. And I think this is a real problem. And I understand the union's thinking here. As much as I hate unions and I think unions are responsible for
sending Australia into just massive pits of debt. Like when you look at Victoria and you think about the massive overruns and you look at those machete bins and you look at all this complete and outright scamming of the Australian taxpayer. But the unions are going to this talk fest and talking about wanting if a company lays off an employee, and like Atlassian, like you talked about last week, if they lay off an employee and replace it with AI, that the person still continues to get paid an AI subsidy for not doing the work, which is basically universal income, but paid for by the company that replaced them with the AI. And at first, as a capitalist, I could see Mark shaking his head, and I get it. Like, as a capitalist, you go, what kind of socialist environment is this? But what kind of choice do we actually have? And should the business, because if you think it through, right, you got a business and they fire an employee that might be on 70 grand a year and they bring in an AI software that might cost them 10. So the $60,000 of job value evaporated. And where does that value accrue? Because they're only going to do it if the replacement of the AI is as good as the person or better. Now, it's probably going to actually be better because they won't have 2 hours of productivity a day. They'll have 24 hours a day of productivity. They won't have any holidays and da 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 da. So anyway, so you've got this business that all of a sudden puts $60,000 straight to their bottom line, right? So these businesses all of a sudden become hugely profitable, right? But if you're in a business-to-business business, like not like Eric's business, which is B2C, but if you're in a B2B, your customers are also experiencing the benefit of firing staff and increased profits, and you're only selling to each other, well, that might be fine. But what happens with a business like Eric, where, well, I mean, fine for the business, obviously not fine for the people losing their jobs. But if you're in a B2C business like Eric and you start firing the people, the consumers are going broke. So the business has this short-term sugar hit of, you know, increased profit. But then the population of workers are losing their jobs, which then kills his business because they don't have any money unless there's UBI coming from the government. Or something like this union's proposal where they're saying, all right, well, if you're going to save $60,000 on losing an employee but not lose any productivity, how about you, I don't know the full details, but maybe what they're saying is pay 30 grand to the government, which then gets paid on as UBI, or it goes straight to the employee. I mean, what, it's a really interesting thought experiment to think how this impacts. Do you guys have any comments on that? Was that too confusing?
What was I reading? I was reading The Technological Republic by Alex Karp, the founder of Palantir. And he was basically saying that since the 1950s or 1960s that there's now so, because the media has become such a large part of society and cultures, like especially in the West, that we've gotten to a point that if you know, someone didn't pay a train ticket or something, that it'd be all over the front page news, right? And what they're basically, what he basically said is that the studies have found that because everything is so heavily put into the limelight now, that the talent in government has actually decreased massively over the last decades, because who the hell in their right mind would want to put themselves under that scrutiny, right, to work in public office? And he basically says, you know, like if you look at the tech companies, the tech companies have basically refused to work with the military because of public pressure and because of employee pressure. And you know, we're moving into a time where really it's for America anyway, it's an arms race versus China, and they really need that support. But the point, the long way of me saying, the point that I'm trying to make is that technology is moving so fast, right? And these changes are coming at us so fast, they're going to have massive ripple effects for many, many years to come. But I don't believe that we've got the leaders in charge that are equipped to game theorize this out or to make the decisions that are going to lead us to a good place, right? Like so many countries, I think, are really going to suffer. There's going to be countries that get it right, and there's going to be countries that suffer, and there's going to be like no in between. And my big fear is that we don't really have the leaders in power to kind of strategize this out and make the right decisions for our country. We've kind of seen that they haven't really made the right decisions over the last 30 years. Like productivity is so far down. Our resources have been sold for peanuts. What hope do we have of getting this right when it's coming at us so fast that even the smartest minds in the world don't actually know how to deal with it?
Well, you know, when you got leaders like I put on those reels, you know, spending the same price as a Ferrari for a steel bin to put machetes in. I mean, I think what Australians should do is, you know, as a vote of no confidence, should go down to the sex shop and buy some dildos and stick them in there and just say, there you go, fill these bins with dildos and come up with a better idea.
How about to put laws in place to begin with so there aren't any machetes? Do you know what I mean? Like the thing is, you know, slaps on the wrist, and we're just creating these Band-Aid, you know, it just doesn't make sense to me. But in my opinion,
we had the lady on the pod who was on the summit during the week, living in Dubai, and we were on that pod. We kicked around. So, like, when you go to Singapore, like, there is no crime, like, not visible like you see in Australia where you need machete bins. I mean, they'd be shot in a heartbeat. Same as Dubai. It's like, you know, how do we bring back a little bit of you know, a stronger form of punishment that's going to deter people to do this stupid shit to start with?
It was called the wooden spoon.
Yeah, right.
Like the wooden spoon is long gone, and I mean that's a whole other debate. But I think going back to you, Adam, that is a problem, right? Because at the end of the day, you need the customers to have the money to keep spending, you know, the disposable income on things, and if they're getting let go, and jobs aren't there to be replaced. I totally understand. And that goes back to that universal basic income theory that, you know, has been talked about for quite some time. And I honestly think, that's where it is going to go.
100% it will.
Because that's what it is. Whether it's paid, where does the money come from? Universal basic income will just not come from the government. It will come from the businesses. It will come from the people, and it will be distributed to a certain amount of people. That it's kind it's already kind of what's happening now. Centerlink is kind of, it's growing, right? Like there's when you look at people on Centerlink that need it, fair enough, but there's a lot of people that are on Centerlink that don't need it, right? And the incentive of going and working for a minimum wage versus what you get on Centerlink.
I agree, Eric. I mean, I can't believe I'm saying this as an entrepreneur, but I would be really interested to think through that idea that if a business replaces a job with an AI and they were profitable with employees in place and they can replace a human being and just put that entire salary to the bottom line, well, you know, is there a case for some kind of I don't know.
It's already happening. It's already happening, Adam.
Yeah,
it's already happening. Like, look at I think it's definitely Nvidia, and I think it's Nvidia, and I don't know which is the other one. Maybe it's Taiwan Semi, or I'm not sure who. But Nvidia now have to give the U.S. government 15% of every single one of the chips that they sell to China. So like, this is a $4 trillion company, right? And so one way or another, like, they're about to, the government is rumored to be about to take a stake in Intel. So one way or another, these, the government or these organizations that are too big to fail, right? Like you look at Facebook, Amazon, Nvidia, these are too big to fail organizations now. And one way or another, they are going to be paying the universal basic income.
Yes.
The other thing, and we're seeing it everywhere, and it's you know, a hot topic, is immigration. The other way to replace bodies or jobs in areas where people can still do them is going to be immigration. It's like, yeah, I agree with you, Adam. Like, everything needs to be considered, right? My concern is not that, you know, Facebook or CBA or whoever it is needs to pay some form of UBI. It's that the small businesses or the medium businesses maybe get hurt in the process.
It's that delineation again, Mark, and this is what seems to be lost. There's no delineation between the small mum and dad shop that is trying to keep a coffee shop open, which we need to protect because that's culture. That's Australian culture for one. But, you know, people don't realise how big these companies are. Like, just here's one something to think about. NVIDIA, their market cap is bigger than the gross domestic product of the UK. It is bigger than the gross domestic product of Germany. Right? They are a bigger entity than entire nations is one company. They have employees, many employees that are billionaires that work there. Like, they are massive companies. So
you could argue like people say, oh, you know, Australia or America, the land of property rights, but you're going to start to see the Western countries start to act more like China, with US characteristics or Western characteristics. That people think that the nationalization won't occur. It's going to happen. Like, you know, you look at MicroStrategy as an example. What's let's say MicroStrategy's bit, I know it's kind of a little bit off topic, but it's kind of the same, right? Because the country has $37 trillion in debt. Let's say that MicroStrategy's Bitcoin gets to $3 trillion. Well, then it's very easy for the US government to step in and kind of take control of that company to pay off some of the debt, pay down some of the debt, right? Like all these things are on the table. We're going through, oh my God, like the change that we're about to go through is so massive.
James? I think about the amount. I was just
going to say back to a real basic example, as you said, we probably don't want to game theory it out, but like an MX store, blue collar workers lose their jobs potentially. And then so people stop riding motocross bikes altogether. Does that whole sector of sport just get wiped out? Well, it's pretty hard to see that happening. But I think it'll go
the other way. I think more people, there'll be more leisure activities because I think people will probably 4-day work week, right? People are going to probably have more time on their hands, and so they're going to it's all this like UBI circle, right? Like they're going to spend their money on things. They're going to spend their money on things like motocross bikes and whatever.
It'll be monopolized, right? You can see it. You can see it happening. I can see it in front of my eyes that what will happen is there will be the haves and the have nots, right? There will be like, you look at, we'll use MXR as an example. There will be, whether it's us or someone else, there will be one main place to do that. There will be, or someone like Amazon comes in and fully takes over. Like Amazon is an online business killer. That's what it is, right? Like when you start looking at what they're actually doing in this scale, like how do you compete? They haven't, like when Amazon actually enter into Australia, which they already have, but when they can start doing the deliveries, if they can, like they are in the US, how do you compete with that, right? Like, and this is the thing, I think things were just gonna get monopolized. Less small business, right? Which means, yes, Mark, people will have more time because the new generation is different already. They're not like us, right? The new generation is all about experience, spending money, you know, live now. You might die tomorrow, this type of thing. You know, our generation was like, save for the future, save for retirement. This all. You think a 21, 22, 23, 24-year-old kid up to 30-year-old are thinking about retirement? You think they're caring about superannuation? And I think that generation will continue to change, right? And then us dinosaurs will die off. And in my opinion, it'll just more and more monopolies will be created. Like you look at what Valuetainment and Harmozy and these types of people online, they'll just grow to this massive scale. And you said it, Mark, these businesses grow to a point where they can never go bad. Like they're bigger than themselves, you know?
I think for entrepreneurs listening to this, and we'll just move back to here, but I think what I would encourage you to do is price intelligence at zero in your business and then add robotics to the world and ask yourself, okay, if you've got intelligence that costs almost zero, and you've got robots that can interact with physical space, what businesses will survive or thrive in that environment? Like Eric's MX store, all those people that are packing shelves could be replaced with intelligence and robotics, right? In very short order. So start thinking about that and then go deep down that rabbit hole. Like, where's the money going to come from? What would be the effect if Eric's business or any business did that? And then what would be the knock on and where would the money have to come from? It's a very interesting thought experiment because in those problems are businesses.
Can I add one more layer to this before we move to the next topic? So I've been listening to a lot of macro podcasts because that's what I do every day, right? And some of the great macro and tech minds out there basically go around in circles, Adam, and think out those experiments and think and strategize out those thoughts. And then you know what they keep saying? They keep coming back to just buying gold or buying Bitcoin. Gold because the fiat currency is going to continue to be debased, but Bitcoin because if we get to a point where everything becomes AI software or AI robotics, you're not going to be trading anymore. It's not going to be you that goes out and trades. It's going to be your AI agent. And so if you leave an AI agent to trade with other AI agents to get the parts and the bits that they need to give to robots, humans are going to be removed from that process. And if that's the way it goes, which is looking more and more likely, the value is going to accrue to the base layer of payment, and the indisputable leader of the base level of payment, the indestructible, is Bitcoin. And so the most pure play to play this AI future is not the simplest way. Like, unless you have above average or an X factor skill set in being able to identify companies, your simplest bet is to save as many fiat dollars as you possibly can and to develop a strategy to acquire Bitcoin with those fiat dollars. That's the simplest play. And, you know, not financial advice, but I just keep hearing this from the smartest macro minds. And sure, if you're in macro or in trading, you're going to go out there and you're going to try and beat Bitcoin. Bitcoin's the hurdle rate. You can always try and beat it and double it. But the simplest play, if this happens, is invest in the base layer.
Well, just one thing to add, another very interesting thing. When we had Natalie here from Dubai talking about robots and humanoid robots, they're already happening in Dubai as we speak. So there's already police patrolling tourist areas and malls. Humanoids, robots, right? They're already in restaurants, hotels, using robot waiters and reception staff, baristas. It's actually happening. It's just, we're so far behind here in Australia. And that's why I'm so excited to go in there. So I can actually, it just opens your mind to actually seeing these things.
And they also announced their Uber drones. So drone drop-offs from the airport. Yeah. It's been in the works for a while now, but they actually announced the commercial prices. They begin early next year, and you'll be able to get from Dubai Airport to the Palm in 10 minutes, a 75% reduction in time, carries 4 passengers plus luggage, and it'll go straight from DBX straight to initially 3 or 4 drop-off locations, and the cost is about 300 dirhams for the flight, which I think... Yeah. It's either 150 Aussie or 600 Aussie. I can't remember whether we're half or double, but it's, yeah. So you'll be able to jump in a quad drone and they'll fly you and drop you straight there, which is phenomenal. So I want to click on this. Go ahead, Mark.
Oh, just last thing. And if our governments don't mess it up and completely destroy our culture and fabric and countries, this is the utopian, this is the utopian scenario that we kind of alluded to last week, right? Think about all this time that you're going to get back. 70% of the time you spend doing things is driving to here or doing the, you're going to get so much time back. And the utopian future, if they can get the universal basic income or the income part right and not go bankrupt, you're going to have all this time to reconnect with other humans. And that's the, you know, but there's a few steps between now and then, but there is a utopian future.
I want to talk about Dubai in a second, and I want to get to that. I just want to just add a couple of comments there, Mark, about your Bitcoin thing, because a couple of big things happened in the week of Bitcoin. And I just want to sort of just, I listened to a few things. I just want to drop a few facts in here. First of all, Harvard were famous about 4 years ago. Harvard came out and said, Bitcoin is more likely to go to $100 than $100,000. And that went all over the Harvard Investment Review Board. Last week, they bought $100 million of Bitcoin at $100,000 plus per coin. So
you get the price you deserve.
So in 4 years, they went from, you know, saying it's more likely to go to $100 than $100,000 when it was like at, I think it was at $25,000 at the time that they said this. And then 4 years later, they're buying it over $100,000. They bought $100 million of it. Grant Cardone just closed a real estate deal in Florida, the largest Bitcoin real estate deal in the world, $235 million transaction that he bought from Blackstone. And he added $100 million of Bitcoin into this deal. And he worked with Michael Saylor on structuring it. So you've got Grant Cardone, who spent 25 years property only, now doing the biggest Bitcoin hybrid transactions in the world. You've got Harvard buying $100 million. Now, this is the most conservative of conservative investors. University foundations and institutions are thinking about generations. They're not thinking about now. They're thinking about generations. You had the president come out and announce that 401ks in America, which is superannuation effectively, but just non-compulsory, can now have cryptocurrency in their 401ks. That is trillions of dollars. You think about how many, I interviewed Matt Fraser this week, who's in Australia, runs a Bitcoin community that helps Australians onboard money from their super. I spoke to Bish this week from Stormrake. He's, and both of them have said, we've got so many super funds, self-managed, that are getting exposure to Bitcoin. And Australia's nothing. Wait till you get American super funds, 401ks, allocating. So all of this activity, and then the last thing I want to say was I listened to this guy today who, a very, very successful Wall Street guy, sold his company in 1982 to a bank for $480 million in 1982. Put all of the money into Apple stocks, made a second fortune, like a multi-billionaire. And this speech was in El Salvador, and he was the keynote. And he said, let me tell you how I found the religion of Bitcoin. And he talked about throughout history, how money has never been something that's been made by man. It's always been seashells, it's been gold, it's been beads, you know, it's been all this raw material-based stuff. And he talked about, you know, like, you are going to lose if the money that you use is controlled by someone else. It's a really interesting talk. But my point, and he said in there that what he's realized is that Bitcoin is not an intelligence test. Bitcoin is actually an ego test. And he said the reason that keeps most people out of Bitcoin is ego. And he said one of his best mates is a very, very wealthy guy. He just cannot accept the fact that I got into Bitcoin at 3,000, and if he gets in, he's getting in at 100. So he's sticking to his guns and he's not buying it because he'll net, you know, very interesting. All I'm saying is, Adam, that there's a lot of writing on the wall there.
Adam, I'm about to interview someone who is consulting one of the Bitcoin treasury companies, and they're the fastest company to go from zero to 2,000 Bitcoin. So not acquired, you know, obviously there's companies that acquired 40,000 Bitcoin in one hit, but the companies that kind of started at zero and then slowly grew it, they're the fastest company to go to from zero to 2,000. And this guy who's a Bitcoin maxi that's been in the space for quite some time, he has a view, macro view, and he's actually the guy that created the chart, you know, the chart that we talk about of all the assets in the world. Mm-hmm. He actually created that chart. Anyway, he basically says that he thinks treasury companies will end up owning 50% of the Bitcoin available. So not only do you have Harvard and all these organizations that are cold storage or holding their own Bitcoin, you've then got the TradFi companies on the stock market that will control the other 50%. So think about the world and the future of what, you know, think gameplay that out, what the world looks like when half the Bitcoin is owned by corporate companies on stock exchanges.
And how thin the supply will be. And and this is what's happening at the moment. It's just forming this new base of investor where, you know, you've got like that one person sold $9 billion worth of Bitcoin in one transaction. And the person who wants to believe Bitcoin is bad will say, why did they sell? What do they know? And I'm like, dude, when you've got $9 billion of an asset that you've gone through hell with for 15 years, it's not like $900, it's $9 billion. Like you would have no idea, let's not even speculate, right?
I can tell you what I can. I'm not going to say I can guarantee you because I can't guarantee you, but I'm almost personally certain that a large portion of that went into a Bitcoin ETF.
Yeah,
because it's just so much easier, right? Like it's just, right. It's so much easier for him to buy IBIT and then sell covered calls. And then there's so much, there's so many tools that you have at your disposal when you take some of your Bitcoin that's gone up crazy amounts and put it into the TradFi rails. There's all these other products around it that you can generate income with.
The point is for the average person to know is that now we've got this $9 billion block that somebody paid $110,000 for. And I interviewed Bish and he said it's Stormrake. He said the guy who sold this or the girl that sold this sold it on a Friday morning in one hit. He said it's the thinnest trading period of all. He said, as a trader, it did my head in because we could have sold that so much more effectively. He said it just all cleared, all got absorbed, and the trading day ended higher. It dipped 3% and then it ended higher for the day after a $9 billion sale. So the point is, there's this huge chunk there that now doesn't have an entry point of a dollar. You know, like now we've got a block that is the base is 110. So this is where the volatility comes out of markets because you've got these new investors that have come in at much higher prices in much more significant value and are much more long-term in their thinking. So it's an interesting
thing. That's how you can judge the price floors is the amount of purchases that have stepped in at say 95, 100, 110. It kind of sets a little bit of a price floor sometimes. Yeah. Someone else said, Adam, recently, and you've probably heard many Bitcoiners say the same thing, that at the end of the day, I think Preston Pish has said it and maybe a few others, that at the end of the day, what he's found is that the difference between the people that own Bitcoin and the people that don't is largely the people that own Bitcoin are the most optimistic about the future and the people that don't tend to be more pessimistic about the future.
Let's move forward. I want to talk about Dubai for a second, Eric, because you had Natalie come over from Dubai. And, you know, I see a lot of leadership in that area. I listened to an interesting podcast this week talking about the impact of Trump's tariffs in the US and how many billions of dollars are being piling up now in the US Treasury from receipts just through his tariff negotiations and putting America first. And at that really first principles thinking that is turning America around fiscally. Now, it's not out of the woods by any stretch, but there's real, like, you know, thought there. And I think a lot of people are looking to America and to Dubai and countries like that where you have competency and power. What did you learn by listening to Dubai, Natalie and her take on Dubai? What was your feeling after she came over? Is it a bubble? Is there underlying strength? Do you think there's going to be a continued inflow of money into Dubai from people around the world? What were your takes on all these things?
To me, it's very basic. If you incentivize, they will come. If they come, you can build. That's what they're doing. They've got the cash, right? They're building massive infrastructure. They're incentivizing high net worth people to go there, right? Mm-hmm. And there is thousands and thousands and thousands of millionaires moving to Dubai every year. We're not talking thousands and thousands and thousands of immigrants that are coming in, right? Migrants that are coming in with no money. We're talking about people with a lot of money going there. People with a lot of money usually are entrepreneurial, right? Or they're inventors, or, you know, they think a little bit differently than the average population if they already have cash of some kind. And in my opinion, they're incentivizing them correctly. And they keep building. So, and they have the money to do so. Like they've got like Dubai, all you got to do is go to Dubai2040.ae and have a read at the infrastructure and the amount of spend and what they're building. It's hard to actually comprehend. It sounds like a lie when you actually come from Australia, you come from Canada, you come from the Western world and the way we do things here, we can't even build standard houses for the people that we have coming in. These guys are they're built. What they're building there is not normal, right? It's hard to actually comprehend. And I just pulled something up here. You know, the government spending at the moment, just in the 2025 fiscal year, $26.6 billion. You know, like they're spending billions and billions of dollars in infrastructure. So, again, Dubai has gone up a lot over the years, but I remember going there 12 years ago. I haven't been there in 12 years, so I'm very excited to go back 12 years ago and people saying it was a bubble.
So you haven't been there for 12 years, Eric? Did you say that?
I've only flown through it, but I actually haven't physically been there for 12 years. It'll be a different ball game for me, right?
You won't even recognize it.
It's infrastructure, it's transport, it's the airport, it's services, it's healthcare. And you know what? Like, I think the Western world, UK, Australia starting, you know, Canada, these countries are doing a very good job at pissing these people off. And Dubai is doing a very, very good job at attracting them. So the biggest BDMs, right, business development managers for Dubai are other countries and other countries' governments, right? And the capital controls and the taxes and the incentive for millionaires, right? And because but the thing is, what we all have to remember is Dubai is built off the back of cheap labor. That's why it is physically impossible to build what they're building here. Impossible. You've got beautiful towers being sold off the plan that you can't even make work. What they're building there are ridiculous amounts of apartments with ridiculous amenities, and they're able to do so, right, with the labor that they're bringing in. And that's what everyone needs to accept.
But that's the arbitrage. That's why the property prices are going up so much, right? The property prices would not be able to go up as much as they are if they didn't have the immigration of millionaires and the cheap costs. I mean, ultimately, that's the arbitrage. As investors, that's what we need to try and find, whether it's Dubai, whether it is.
And China's doing the same thing. And the other thing that they're doing is they're outsourcing the marketing to influencers. So in Dubai, as Natalie said on the pod, they're incentivizing influencers with golden visas. If you've got X amount of followers, they'll invest in a studio to help you set up or anything, depending on what kind of content you want. They're going to help fund you in getting established to create the content. In China, they've done the same thing. They're offering business class flights, five-star hotels. If you are an influencer and you come to China and you post positive things about China, they'll fund all of that for you from the government. And so it's this kind of, and meanwhile, we've got councillors that think that solving the problem is a fucking machete bin under bright lights outside of a outside of a fucking police station.
Adam, that's I think you've summed it up best. Like, that is my biggest problem and biggest frustration. I hate talking about immigration and all these different things because I'm in the camp that believes we need immigration to keep the economy going and not cause a bloody depression across the whole country. But the thing that really frustrates me is that's what we're getting here. We're getting machete bins. We're not getting forward thinking. We're not getting leaders. We're not getting leaders who are smart enough to embrace the technologies and the industries of the future. If you give me that, and if you give most Australians that, I doubt that they'll be worrying about immigration and all these other things because there's some optimism.
There's that complexity index thing that we've talked about before. Like, Australia is ranked 130th or something, 110 in the world for complexity of our work. We dig holes. That's basically where most of our money comes from. And why that matters is intelligence leaves when that's what's incentivized. And like, you look at like a stat that I saw this week, right? Now this might be divisive, but it was on Channel 7 News. I saw it yesterday that in Australia, there has been an explosion in the number of six-year-old boys that are being diagnosed with autism and learning difficulties. And you go, oh, okay, that headline is concerning, right? So what is this explosion? Well, if you are under seven in Australia, you get $16,500 a year on the NDIS if your child is diagnosed with these two conditions. From 2013 to today, it's gone up 50x, the number of six-year-old boys when the cap's seven, age seven. There's a 50x increase in the number of boys being diagnosed. We've gone from 1 billion claims a year on NDIS to $49 billion of claims on NDIS for this one specific condition that the Courier Mail came out and said there are grave concerns that this is being manipulated. You think so? Do you think, you think like when you incentivize families with 16 and a half, now I know there are families that are genuinely dealing with this problem and I'm sensitive to you. Know, you should be the ones that are most vocal, by the way, because there's all these assholes that are fraudulently, in my opinion, that's fraud. How can it be a 50x increase? And before you say, oh, okay, six-year-olds, they must have been babies that were born after the COVID jabs. They have this challenge. No, COVID jab wasn't issued till February 2021. So these kids were conceived before COVID.
Don't forget that. Then on top of that, and I know this because I've got some female friends that are going through it as well, once they get the rubber stamp that the child's got autism, ADHD, whatever, they can go and get the carer's pension as well and then leave the workforce. And pretty much when you balance it out, if they work their ass off, minus the tax, minus childcare, minus all the running around and all the shit that goes, well, not shit, all the chores that go with rearing children, there's no incentive to work. You've can run the numbers backwards. So if you have two children with autism, then you can only get your lump sum and all the other medicals involved. You then get a carer's pension, which is completely de-incentivized. You go to work. And then you look at
Dubai, and you look at the incentive structures. And so I want to bring it back to a place that is booming on all fronts. And it's because they're attracting intelligence, they're incentivizing all of these things. China, if China starts to do the same thing, I mean, they're building massive infrastructure cities. What if they started to invite the world into China? Like Australia is an amazing place. And this is why I posted that thing, which I've had, I sat on it for a couple of days when I called out Jacinda Allen for gifting the house to a grandmother who's Muslim. I did it because I knew it would get attention, but also because I think it's wrong, right? Like you're incentivizing the wrong things. If you want to bring someone into this country as an immigrant, bring somebody that's going to create jobs. Like there are Muslim people in Australia that are fantastic Muslim families that create jobs. Like I've got a follower, Dr. Lena. She's one of our clients. She's got 50 employees. She's a proud Muslim woman. She has 50 employees. She pays her taxes. She's a loud advocate within the Muslim community saying, listen, ladies, we have to work. We have to contribute. Because in the UK, as I said, I showed the numbers in the UK, 75% of Muslim female women that immigrate to the UK do not work and on average have, and they rely on benefits and get free accommodation. And they have an average 6 to 8 kids. Right. So why are we incentivizing that? Right. Like we've got to incentivize. If you're going to give somebody a golden visa to come to Australia or the ability to come, get them at an age where they can do a job that we need, pay taxes or create jobs, like incentivize the right thing. Right.
I mean, if you went back one step, we go just before we jump too far away from that initial headline piece there. It'd be interesting to run the same stats against every other country on the planet. Their six-year-old boys have had a 10x increase in these mental illnesses. Show me, and I'll show you the outcome.
See if there's a correlation. Well, I think it was Pauline Hanson and Malcolm when they came on the pod said, isn't it interesting that we have 30% more Aboriginals in the country since we started offering benefits? it's not like a growing population in Australia, right? But all of a sudden, we've got a whole bunch more Aboriginals because, of course, we've incentivized them. Right?
You know what the sad thing is, though, is you actually have kids out there, right, that need these services and need these services badly. And then what happens is you get people that jump on the bandwagon doing the wrong thing, and then everybody gets painted with the same brush. That's a problem. That is a major, major problem, right? Because there are these services that are actually required. And then it's every scheme that comes into play, you know, like the insulation scheme. NDIS is the new scheme. And to be honest with you, they've built a monster. And like you said before about the genie in the bottle, And how do you fix it? There's that many people relying on this income now that if you were just to abolish NDIS, Australia would go into the biggest recession they've ever would have ever seen before, in my opinion. That's how much money is being circulated in one industry.
Eric, just
and the people. Sorry, one second. I know people that are in the industry, and they joke to me about it.
100%.
They actually joke to me about it. They're like, you're sitting around, right, having a chat about business and different things, and they actually know that they're taking the piss.
Eric, I had to listen to it twice. Like, I thought, no, I didn't hear that right on the Channel 7 news report. I listened to it twice and then a third time when they said that there's been the number of claims for this one category, right, went from 1 billion with a B claims to 49 billion claims on this one area of the NDIS in Australia. Think about that for a minute. In a population of 24 million people, there's 49 billion claims for this
Adam,
one thing.
Now you know why people in Australia aren't marching for the problems of Australia, because they're just sitting at back and taking the claims.
It's so foreign. No, it is so foreign to me as an entrepreneur.
People are like, but
to wake up every day and go and hunt when others just sit there and fucking take from the taxpayers.
But this comes back to the main point and the big frustration for me, and I think something that you alluded to before. I can get on board with the businesses paying the UBI. You know how I can get on board with that? Because if you look through history, the countries that win are the countries that can build. If you look at the Ukraine, the US-Ukraine proxy war versus Russia, Russia won that war because they were able to outproduce Ukraine and America 4-1 with artillery and shells and everything like that. The countries that can build throughout history are the countries that win and prosper. So I don't want Australia to become a welfare state, because what that means is if we become a welfare state, we're destroying and making extinct all of our builders. Let's put in place policies that create more builders. I don't care if you're bringing in Muslims, Italian, Asians, I don't care, Africans, I don't care where you're bringing people in from. Keep the immigration going, but bring in builders that can add prosperity to more and more people, that can hire more and more people.
That because integrate.
That's how we're going to be a country that thrives and survives. If we just become a welfare state, right, we're just going to be China's bitch. That's what we will be. So,
did you swear again? Is that another?
Yeah, that's
Satoshi?
Two for you. I think we called Adam one about 5 minutes ago. As well,
that's to be clear. Two Satoshis. I'll send you my QR. Here's the QR code. Here, scan in my QR code.
No, but do you know, like we want to control some of our destiny, some of our future, and like, why don't we encourage builder policies?
Our destiny is held in very few hands, Mark, unfortunately. That is the reality.
We need these things thought through. And, you know, it was a big epiphany for me during the week to actually consider the idea that businesses may be right for businesses to pay towards UBI. And like, as a capitalist, I was like, oh. But then I was like, actually, that kind of makes sense that you're going to have to do something. There's going to have to be some suspicion. I think it's just... What I'm trying to do here is get people to have more interesting barbecue discussions in Australia. And I think the other fight that we're in is just really making sure, and that the reason I ended my reel the other day was saying, talking about the speakers in Lakemba, you know, saying how this mosque applied to the council to have speakers erected to do call to prayer. Now that to me is like, okay, where's the line? Where do we have to redefine or really decide as a nation, like, what is Australia? And I know when I go to Japan, I love going to Japan because it feels like Japan. It's not like anywhere else in the world. They haven't allowed the West to completely corrupt what they are. I love going to the Middle East, and I love hearing the calls to prayer, and I love seeing the mosques. They're beautiful. I went to the White Mosque, one of the most beautiful places in the world, right? But what makes it special is we don't have that, right? That's the contrast of life is what makes it life. And I don't think we should go in there if we tried to erect a Christian church and broadcast out somebody reading the Bible next to a mosque. Like, it's not going to work, and it shouldn't. We should respect the culture and history of that country, which happens to be, yes, religiously based. So I think, you know, as Australia, we're at this real interesting moment where we really have to decide what is Australian life, what does it stand for, what do we value, and then if we welcome people in, which I'm happy for, welcome the right people in who will honour and respect the traditions. I think it's Norway. They've now banned the burqa, and they've said, no, if you want to be here, it's not allowed here. That's not our culture. This is our country. This is the way we roll, and you need to adapt. And I think that's a good thing.
I think you've had someone with a lady we had in the podcast been banging this drum for 20, 30 years now.
Correct.
Yeah. It hasn't really changed. So
I love having people like, you know, Dr. Lena, who's in our community in Sydney, and she and I, you know, have been head to head over the last week or two on a lot of stuff. But at the core of her, she's an integrated Muslim into this country. She works hard, and that's great. Those people are awesome. Like, it's, anyway, a lot there to chew on, but I hope Aussies are having these interesting conversations. And I don't think the average Aussie is racist at all. They just want to make sure we protect what we have. And I think the other part of it, Mark, is like, if people are going to be on UBI, I think it's important that the government starts to go, okay, well, how can they contribute in a meaningful way to get this UBI? Could it be volunteering at old people's homes or supporting people genuinely in need? Instead of paying NDIS workers, you actually go and support somebody who actually is actually genuinely in need, and we sort of return to a bit of that utopian value thing. You're getting paid for doing nothing, which is okay. What sort of society do we want to build? I mean, I think it's probably a bit optimistic and roses and fairies. I think a lot of Australians are, fuck you, just bring that 4X to the door.
But Adam, that is probably the most pertinent question of the podcast. What society do we want to build? Because if AI does what we think AI is going to do, every country has going to have the opportunity to build the kind of society they want to build. And that is the biggest question, right? And the problem is that the 4-year political cycle doesn't lend itself to answering or working on that big question. And, you know, that is the question. That is the question that China asks. That is the question that Russia asks. When they think about what kind of country do we want to be in 100 years, in 30 years, right? And you can agree with them or not, but the point is, we need to ask the question, what kind of country do we want to be in 20 years, 30 years?
And I go back to something like a country like Dubai as an example. Just read something here going back in 2007, right? One out of every 4 cranes was in Dubai. That's 2007. How long ago is that? Do the calculations. 18 years ago, right? So they knew what they were doing a long time before they're doing it. Now everyone sees it going, oh my God, they've built so much. They've been doing it for a long time, just compounding and compounding. And they have a plan, right? The 2040 Dubai master plan, like what they're doing there is next level. But that comes with massive, strong leadership with a huge vision and a mission. And they're literally attracting so many people. They want to almost double their population by 2040. Like that's 15 years away.
I'd be interested to know what they pay their leaders and see what we can learn. Singapore is the same. Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew is an incredible visionary. And they started with a hell of a lot less than Australia did.
I'd love someone to go and study their media, right? And see if their media whips their politicians, right? I doubt that happens. And maybe the answer, you know, according to smarter people than me reading this book, The Technological Republic, maybe the answer is to stop bloody whipping our politicians, which we are doing as well.
I've said it a million times, Mark, that why would you, if you could go in politics in Australia? That's where I've lost so much hope, is because there's no incentive. And it's actually a massive difference because we're so brutal on politicians here.
And the UK is the same, and they're the other big Western country that's kind of going to shit, right? Their media is so harsh.
And social media and things. It's a really interesting dilemma. But another big cornerstone of these emerging countries is their stance on crime. And, you know, Australia, I just got tired of it. I'd sit there and read my paper on a Friday morning at the Hot Shots coffee shop in Main Beach, And every single day was another story of a grandmother being punched in the head or hit by a cricket bat. And then the guy gets out, you know, he's got mental health issues. He's got 3 months probation. You know, like, what? Where's the incentive to not commit crime? You try that shit in Dubai, see how you go. You try that shit in Singapore, see how you go.
Someone said that in Dubai, you can leave your wallet at the bar or at the restaurant, forget it, come back 8 hours later, and it'll be in the exact same spot. Man, if you did that in Australia, your credit card would be used 4 or 5 times in between that.
That's 100%.
And you'll go back to your wallet, and it'll be empty, but there'll be like a picture of a dick or something in there. That's what I'm just trying.
In Japan, they have vending machines with alcohol in them. They have a little sticker on it that says, if you're over 18, if you're under 18, please don't use this machine. And nobody does. Imagine how well that'd go in Australia. Like, it's just like we've got these cultural problems. And until we start getting a stance on crime, and just to show you, like with Dubai, how smart they are with this stuff. People go, why did they pay $1 billion to Ronaldo to play soccer there? Like, where's the return on that? Well, the return is, Ronaldo's got the biggest Instagram account in the world. The return is that if the world sees that it's safe enough for Ronaldo and his family to go in what some people might consider a dangerous, you know, Middle Eastern country, all of a sudden that rebrands the country. It's worth every cent.
But all Australia vision doesn't and have strategy.
Exactly. It's vision and strategy.
Like Simon Squibb, who our podcast just went live today, he told us, I'm not sure if it was on camera or off camera, that the UAE paid him $1 million US to go there just so he could roam the streets and ask people, what's your dream? You want to know why? Because he gets 400 to 500 million organic views a month across his platforms. That's why.
Right. More than the BBC from his cell phone on his
it's rocket science stuff, guys. It really is rocket science. Honestly.
What's the lady's name? The car influencer in Australia just been shipped over
Supercar
there.
Supercar Blondie.
They just funded her.
Yeah, they funded her. She says that they're trying to attract 10,000 content creators that they will incentivize podcast studios. Why? Because they got the biggest megaphones. That's why.
This week, Eric, I've had 4 separate couples come and visit me here in Cyprus from Australia, and I'm nobody. I'm a tiny, tiny, tiny influencer. But that's 4 families from Australia that are relocating to Cyprus or seriously considering it enough to come over here for 2 weeks just because I'm here, and I haven't even really been marketing it. I haven't really done anything. Yeah. Imagine somebody like Simon Squibb with 17 million followers. If Simon Squibb said, you know what, I've left the UK, I've realized that the dream could be achieved here in Dubai a lot quicker than in London. You're talking tens of thousands of families that would come over.
But you know what will happen is this. The negativity will start in the comments. It's a shithole. You can't live in there for 6 months a year. They get dust storms, blah, blah, blah. This is the mentality of people. Instead of going, you know what, we're going there. In 2 months, we're going to be going there, right? And we're going to check it out. Doesn't mean that we're moving there. Doesn't mean that we're going to be... I want to see it from an investment standpoint. I want to see it for myself rather than reading articles and ChatGPT these statistics. I want to see it for my own eyes and see how it is.
Eric, it's maybe, like maybe it's that's, not a test of intelligence, it's a test of ego. Mark?
Maybe just thinking this through, right, thinking this forward a little bit, maybe this is the future crop of politicians, right? Like if you look at in the United States, the only person who was able to get in and kind of break that neocon mold has been Trump. And he basically was able to do that because he brought a media empire with him. So he was able to go toe to toe with the mainstream CNBC, Fox News, the media, right? So he had the ability to go toe to toe with them, and therefore he's been able to endure. So maybe the future politicians and the future leaders that are going to lead us forward are going to be these massive, you laugh now, but you know, give them 10 years, 15 years to mature and to get used to their fame, fortune, wealth and responsibility that brings. And these are probably going to be the people that are going to be running for politics. Totally. And so, you know, you kind of have another scenario in 10, 20 years time where the future looks bright again. That'll align up with a first turning. And, you know, it's going to be these guys with influence that are going to be our leaders. So, you know, we come on every week and kind of talk about these topics because they're the hot topics of the day. But I hand on heart, 100% genuinely believe that the future, when my kid is 15, 16, 20, that future is going to be so much brighter than what we're giving credit for today.
Great stuff. On that note, Mark, I think we might bring it to an end. I just want to just drop something right at the end here, which is totally unplanned. I just want to do this as an experiment if you've followed this far. We're planning a trip to Dubai, and we're looking at the 23rd to the 26th of October, around that time where we'll be there. So probably the 23rd and 24th, we're thinking at the moment. And what we're going to do it is we're going to do it in association with Natalie. Initially, it was just our inner circle of friends, and it may still be that, depending on the interest level. But we're talking about doing 2 days where we do a tour in Dubai with Natalie. So we're going to do half a day in a room together, where we're going to have some of the government people come in and some of the high level property people come in and talk to us. Then we're going to go have lunch. Then we're going to jump in a bus, go see some of the showrooms for these new developments around Dubai, and then we're going to have a second day, similar, half in a room networking and talking about opportunities in Dubai. We might bring our AI trading team in and a bunch of other stuff that we're doing out there, and then spend half a day just at a pool and party and into the night. So we're thinking of putting something together. We're definitely doing it for our inner circle of friends, but I just want to see out of our followers, if it was like, say, $5,000 for 2 days, all in for food, us to organize at hotel rooms, if we did it at a little bit more of a scale and really laid it on for you, let's say somewhere like $4,000 or $5,000, who would come? And if you would, send an email to support@unemployable.com.au. It'll be a high-level group of guys. Like, you're talking a lot of eight-figure net worth guys and up. And if you're not there, that's cool. If you want to come, hang out with us anyway. But come and let us know. Send an email to support@unemployable.com.au.
Actually, do you want to send it to support or hello?
Hello, sorry, hello. Send it to hello@unemployable.com.au, hello@unemployable. Just let us know if it was then, say the 23rd to 26th, just out of interest, Blockchain Life is on the following week in Dubai, 28th and 29th, which I'll be going to. So you can hang out a few more days if you want to, but just let us know if you want to join us. But at the moment, it's probably going to be about 15 to 20 of us that are in private WhatsApp groups together, all high net worth guys. Just let us know if you'd like to come. So it's going to be Natalie, Eric, myself, a whole bunch of people. It's going to be a super, super time. With that said, guys, let's wind up the pod. Thanks for joining us today, guys. Drop a comment below if you found this helpful. And the best thing you can do is tell people about the pod and make sure you're subscribed. Bye for now.
Hey there. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Unemployable. If you'd like to watch another episode, just click there.